Hello, everybody. Welcome to Topical Fever, Episode 4. My name is David Parsons, and I cannot thank you enough for listening to these conversations, and I hope you're enjoying them. Today, I brought in my friend Jeff Johnson. Jeff is a teacher and an activist and someone who I've known for many, many years, who I've always depended upon to kind of break down the political situation. He's really great at articulating his knowledge, and he has a lot of that knowledge. And he would be humble about that, but I brought him in because I wanted to talk to him about Iran specifically. He's been working with an organization called Havar. That's H-A-V-A-A-R, and you can find more about the organization at havar.org. Havar is a group of activists, both Iranians and Iranian-Americans and people like Jeff, who are all concerned about the effects of economic sanctions led by the United States on the lives of ordinary Iranians. And they're trying to organize different efforts to try and stop those sanctions or at least ameliorate some of their negative effects and stop the United States from warmongering against Iran. So we talk about that. We talk about the problematic history of the United States and Iran and give a little bit of that history. And we talk a lot about the film Argo. I have not seen that film, and I was really curious to know what Jeff thought about it, because I know he's been working a lot and thinking a lot about Iran in the last few years, and I know it's kind of one of his most important issues among many that I hope he comes in to the studio to talk to me about eventually. But either way, this is a conversation that also includes a little bit of the dry and bizarre sense of humor that Jeff and I have developed over the years, so that's definitely evident in this interaction. But I hope Jeff comes in more because I think he's really great at not only breaking down what's important about what's going on politically in the world, but also there's always a very appealing kind of humanity underlying what he's saying. I think Jeff has his heart in the right place, and so. I hope you enjoy this conversation between Jeff Johnson and me about Iran and the United States. So I am here with my friend Jeff Johnson, who I've known for many years and has been one of my favorite people to talk about politics and many other topics with. But, you know, thank you, Jeff, for coming by. It's a beautiful day in Brooklyn, isn't it?
Thanks, David. And I've always said for years that I would never do a podcast, you know, really going back to the 80s.
Yeah, people would tell me. You were one of the first people actually to say, I'll never do a podcast
right.
in the 80s.
And people back then would say, Jeff, you should do it, you should do it. And I said, no, I won't. And this is my first time because I just feel like it's just too important.
It's really an honor that you're here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I know you've been against it for a while, but what I hope is that this is the beginning of a wonderful podcast career for you, because
right.
I think, you know, it, maybe you've been resistant to it because you've got it in you, you know, this is maybe your calling.
I've been worried it's too deep in me, so we'll see how this goes.
All right, well, let's get that out of you and let's spend an hour getting it out of you.
Great.
So I brought you on to talk about Iran because you're probably the person, or I know definitely the person that knows most about it that I know personally. You know,
right.
Obviously there are people that know so much more than you. I mean, I can't even imagine.
Per se, actual Iranians,
yeah,
for example,
right? Things like that. But you're a person that, you know, you're a friend of mine, and you're involved in this. And you know, I have Iran comes up a lot in my teaching because I teach a lot of 20th century American history, and you can't really teach the 70s and early 80s without engaging this question. And obviously that's related to the history of Iran, which I want to get into a little bit. But there's a lot going on right now with Iran in terms of American media because of Argo winning Best Picture at the Academy Awards, which, as we know, is kind of the objective... they're like the ultimate kind of judge of what a good movie is.
Right.
Right.
Of course.
That how you would describe the Academy Awards?
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
And you can't argue against it.
That's what makes it difficult, because if Argo,
right.
I hear all these critics of Argo saying it's bad, but there goes a motorcycle in Brooklyn. Hold
right.
on. But I hear all these critics saying that Argo, has this or that kind of problem with it, whether it be its portrayal of Iranians or whether it be its portrayal of the whole story or its switching of the of another thing that I know about it is that the original guy was actually a Latin American
Right.
But Ben Affleck played him in the movie. But when I hear that stuff, I think, how can that be? Like, how can Argo have these things wrong with it if they gave it Best Picture?
It has a little gold statue.
Right. So
it doesn't make a great deal of sense.
Can we reconcile that? Because I bring it up because you've actually seen Argo.
I have seen it.
And you had a particularly unique experience in seeing Argo, in a sense.
Yes, I actually I'm involved with this group that I'll talk a little bit about later, I guess, called Havar. That's a group of Iranians and Iranian-Americans. It's anti-war. I watched it with some people connected with that group. And we'd been aware of this movie for a while and kind of leery of it just because one of the things I think is interesting about, and to take your point about the Oscars, obviously, you know, very often the best picture is not the best picture.
Right.
This is a pretty strong example of that, I would say. It's on one level, it's actually just a bad movie. I liked some of Ben Affleck's other movies, like his first movie. I thought was great, but
which was it? Which one are you calling his first movie?
Bon Baby Gone.
Gone Baby Gone. Yeah, no, that was great. That was good. That was good, and the town was okay.
It was okay.
Yeah,
this is awful. This is cinematically awful. But
I don't want to make this about movies.
No,
but
it's less.
I think when a similar moment is when Crash won Best Picture,
yes,
and I think that was like
2004
something like that. That was a moment for me where I was kind of like, I think that might be it. With me paying attention to this at all,
David,
it was such a terrible movie.
I'm so glad you said that. no, because actually, I thought that it's weird. Like Argo, I've thought of as being analogous to Crash in my weird mind, because it's this film. People are like, "Oh, this is smart and good and political
interesting,"
it's like this it's liberal overtone to it, or whatever.
Yeah.
But Argo, I mean, forget the cinematic aspect, which I thought sucked. It's problematic to just have any film or any sort of, to an extent, media content from the U.S. out about Iran right now, because it just plays into this larger narrative of the conflict between the U.S. and Iran, or Iran and Israel, and the threat of Iran. But Argo had, you know, a lot of the typical problems that Western movies or television have vis-a-vis the Middle East, the Arab world, or Iranians.
All
certainly, there's been examples.
Edward Said stuff.
Yes, yeah. There's words for this. Yes,
yeah.
And it's much more toned down. You know, Ben Affleck's like a good liberal, and George Clooney produced it, and he's a liberal. And I'm sure these guys they're probably opposed to war with Iran. I bet they genuinely are, and just a little bit clueless. But yeah, I mean, some of the problems with the movie is it actually starts with this nice historical montage that's okay, and this can lead us into talking about some of the history next, maybe. Where it acknowledges the historical role of the United States in terms of 1953, the CIA overthrows the government of the elected.
How does it acknowledge that? Cause I'm just curious.
Through a sort of
like a voiceover?
Like a filmic montage that actually kind of nicely cuts between actual clips and seamlessly into reenactments of that clip that was actually done well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was presented well.
I fully expect the movie to be technically really well done.
It's pretty well done. The costumes are amazing, actually.
Yeah.
That's what I thought about it. It's like the period piece aspect of
it. Like those sideburns are really convincing.
They're really well done. And if
those huge collars
great. I talked with someone before I saw it even, who just enjoyed it she was like, "I just remember that late 70s and it was really cool to see that." And I'm like, okay, fair enough. But there's a lot of
other
stuff.
If you have $30 million budget, you better get some good.
Yeah.
The clothes better look good.
Yeah, but they didn't even write a script. That's what's
messed
up about it, is that they just fucking forgot to actually get someone to
write
it well. It's really not well written. But so they start with this historical montage sort of thing. And then, you know, the U.S. did this problematic thing where they overthrew the democratically elected government. The CIA did it, and it was over oil. It was very, blatant imperialism for the U.S. and
did they
England.
Use that word? Imperialism?
They certainly did not use the word imperialism.
I don't expect you to remember every
detail.
I'm just really curious about what this movie
is. I'm almost positive they didn't use that word, but it made it a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Shah comes into power, and the Shah is very repressive. And then we get to 1979, and the Iranian Revolution happens, and boom, let's start the movie there.
Right.
But the rest of the movie, there's no calling back to this historical reality, right? Or a sense that the reason you end up in the Iran hostage crisis, which, that wasn't a good thing that everyone should be happy about. I mean, these people who were held hostage were subjected to some not great treatment at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything I'm in favor of. But there's a reason it happened. There's a reason it happened at the embassy. The embassy was involved in the original coup. There's a reason that people were mad right then. They were mad because the Shah, who'd been overthrown, was back in the U.S.
Can we explain a little bit of that history?
Let's do that for a bit, and we'll come back to that.
Yeah, because and we can get back to Argo, because
and then we can just kind of poop on it and move on.
Before, we'll get to the pooping. be patient.
I've actually started, okay. But that's a separate thing from
I
mine.
Wish you had told me. Yeah.
You'll know.
I wondered.
Yeah.
So you have, what was, what, we always start, I mean, I feel like the story always starts in 1953. And for, maybe for people that don't know that, you know, that might sound weird to you, but I feel like, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with the story. I've heard, you know, the Iran story, you know, I've read about it in a lot of different things, and I know a little bit about it, but the story always seems to start in 1953.
Right.
And so, do you know anything about, like, what Iran was before that? Like, what was overthrown in 1953?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not, honestly, I'm going to not do this as well as I maybe could have years ago, not as well as some people would, but yeah, so I mean, what, Mohammad Mossadegh was the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, and I forget the year of his election. It was not too long before that. There had been, you know, a ruling monarchy prior to this, Reza Shah, going back to the 20s, who was a sort of like Ataturk, like secularizing, like in Turkey, kind of, you know, let's be like the West kind of guy.
Right.
And there's some, and honestly, it's embarrassing, but I, you know, there's a transition to the point where you get to this Mossadegh, who is basically sort of a liberal nationalist, right?
Okay.
So what he does is the Anglo-Iranian oil company had been this obviously important oil interest controlled by Great Britain, mm-hmm. and as people often were doing in quote-unquote the Third World back then, he nationalized it.
Right.
And this is pisses off the British and the West to no end.
Anytime you nationalize an industry, you can expect to be assassinated by the United States government.
You will immediately be removed from power right. and thrown into a tank of piranhas.
Or perhaps given some sort of slow-burning cancer that kills you at 53 years old.
Ooh.
Or wait, was he 58?
Or are we in a new podcast all of a sudden? We just crossed over into...
We just switched to Mexico.
South Mexico.
Yeah, South Mexico. I think Chavez was 58.
Slow-burning cancer.
All right.
Great. Yeah, so this is... And
so they nationalize. He nationalizes it.
Nationalizes oil. And he was essentially, you know, I guess I'd describe my understanding as, I mean, he wasn't some...
Was this even the CIA that did this?
The CIA was sort of like... Britain. No, it was much more the CIA. Britain had the financial interest, the economic interest.
Right.
But the CIA did the dirty work.
Interesting to think this is the same moment that the CIA is with Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam trying to like...
Well, and it's also just before they do Guatemala. Like the CIA has this double 1-2 in their eyes, wildly successful coup d'etats that they engine, mm-hmm. which from their perspective at the time were.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's like, Iran, that was great. And then you check in, you know, 26 years later and you're like, shit.
Look, okay,
you
so
know, and this, then Guatemala, same
so
thing.
So the CIA effectively instigates a coup in Iran in 1953, and right. the result of which is the United States essentially installs this figure referred to
as the Shah, who has
an actual name.
Yeah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi.
Right.
And he's descended from Reza Shah, he's his son, I'm pretty sure.
And so now
and
the U.S.
becomes essentially a king. The Shah is akin to that, right? And he's a toady for the U.S. government and the British government, and the oil is back under some kind of arrangement with the West.
And how is he regarded by the majority of people in Iran? Is he a shitty guy?
Yeah, he's regarded very negatively. This was they'd elected a president democratically and he'd been removed.
Was he regarded as a puppet of the West?
Yes.
100%.
And I mean, obviously there's variations in this and there's different people who support him in certain
classes. There's always loyalists.
But he was extremely repressive. He particularly killed off the left over the course of the next few decades, which ironically paved the way for the religious right to take power by the time you get to the 80s. His police force called Savak, internal police force, was horrific.
So there, it's repressive. There's not a lot of human rights going on.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of human rights violations.
A lot of human rights. There's not political freedom. I mean, at the same time, he's a Western modernizer, right?
Right.
So maybe
it's
sort of a good time to be a woman in Iran. Like, yes. Right, you can go to school, maybe. I'm not going to exaggerate that, but he's not a religious reactionary.
This is something I want to get to, actually, because a woman, and we will get to this because I want to get to the 79 revolution in a minute, but... Just remind me to get back to this because there was a student, a woman that came up to me who's a 57-year-old Iranian woman. She's a student in my class, and she told me that she had fled the revolution because of the way that they treated women. And it was she'd been reading about American slavery, and she was crying basically about this stuff. And she told me that when she was reading about American slavery, and specifically about slaves running away from slavery, mm-hmm. she was very emotional because she had participated in a diaspora herself, and she felt like the new regime that took over in 79 was slavery for women.
Right.
And like that's how she felt about it.
Right.
And so it's complicated stuff. But I want to hear I want to hear more about how you kind of think about that, because it's stuff that baits the West so much, you right. know, like the treatment of women. It's something that's so easy to kind of paint with a broad brush.
Right.
But back to, I mean, 53, after you get the Shah in, we have a period of what, about 26 years.
Right.
In which he's ruling, right?
Yeah, in which Iran is the way that like the Nixon administration talked about it, Iran was the regional ally of the West, right? This was like Kissinger's sense of how to run the world. Is like in every corner of the world, you have your pretty powerful country your boy,
yeah,
and that kind of takes care of stuff for you, right? And that was what Iran was.
Some diplomat said he might be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Yeah, that's what like that was yeah. Somoza for, yeah. Or supposedly Somoza. I think it was actually Trujillo, but similarly.
You say
that,
Somoza,
right?
And I'm hungry now.
Right. Well, again, that's yeah. why earlier I was pooping from
right.
what I.
Sorry. Sorry about all that.
This is my first podcast. I didn't plan ahead with the bathroom.
So 53.
Right. So we get, so this
53 to 79 is a period in which the Shah is running Iran, and it's clear that he's a puppet of the United States.
It's a puppet.
And so you've got this difficult situation in which Iran is experiencing a kind of a kind of cultural liberalization in a certain way, in a certain respect, right?
Well, certainly a westernization of certain aspects
because I can tell you, like, I mean, on the
obviously that's a problematic word to even say westernization in this
yeah,
context.
Right,
it's ridiculous, but
the website Reddit, they do a lot of like the atheists on there. They like to point out like how shitty Muslims are all the time. Like
yeah.
that's their like take on that. Atheism yeah. is we hate Muslims.
Right.
And they're one of the things they do a lot is they post pictures of this period of Iran. They post
right.
periods of like basically the 60s and 70s in
right.
Iran, and they show women wearing skirts and women going like hanging out in universities.
Right.
And it's like, and the tone of it is always like, look at the good old days in Iran before the big scary Muslims took over in 79.
Right.
And the obvious kind of it's the obvious kind of prejudice is amazing, but it's at the same time it's this is the evidence they use to suggest that that the revolution was a bad thing for Iranians, specifically women.
Right. Which, I mean, in a lot of ways you can make that argument. I mean, that's what's interesting about that is if you compare it to today. I mean, my understanding, I was just talking with a friend about this, is that I mean, the rates of Iranian women in engineering universities programs,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's actually being dialed back a bit now and there's changes in policy, is higher than it is in the United States. So, while on the one hand...
You mean today?
Today.
Okay.
Now. Right now.
See, that's good to know.
And, I mean, don't...
Because you get the idea from the media or from Reddit or whatever that, like, women are literally in chains in Iran right now.
And you don't want to go too far in that direction because there's all these... I mean, they're putting through this law that, like, in order to be... You know, and I have good friends who are Iranian and who are women and who, in order to leave the country, you'll need permission from your husband or father, from a man, right? I mean, I don't, you know,
and,
you don't want to go in the other direction.
Also,
it's just
that
the whole...
That also might be an expression of how shitty the American higher education system has become.
Yeah, well, that's
and particularly at attracting women to the sciences.
Right,
and
I mean, actually, I think there's probably a lot of countries that, you know, blow the U.S. out of the water in terms of that.
Right.
But, I mean, the point is, and I'm not one to speak, I don't want to speak with any level of expertise about these things, and not my place to do so, but you don't... Anything about, you know, sort of Iran and the treatment of women or
right.
Western is and or what it means to be a woman in Iran, what it means to be a Muslim woman in Iran or a non, you know, these are extremely, extremely complex questions
and
categories.
Often extremely disingenuous conversations that we have about it.
When
we have the conversation here,
it's in service of some other point.
Right.
Look at how bad this group is. Look at how good this group
is. I think that's the point I'm trying to make is that, like,
right.
I mean, the atheists of Reddit, whatever, they represent a certain kind of attitude that I see in the media a lot,
right.
which is the kind of like, well, they treat women like shit, so fuck them.
Right.
And that's
right.
it. And it's a way to, like, write off everything. I mean, you're
right.
seeing it a lot with Venezuela right now, with Chavez being dead, is that it's just like, well, he didn't have free speech,
right.
and so he was a dictator,
right.
and by saying things like that, it takes it completely out of context,
right.
and completely smashes it. And that's why I call it bait. I mean, at a certain point, I think George W. Bush would have had us believe that we bombed Afghanistan to free the women there.
Right.
And
oh, absolutely.
And so
I mean, they basically said that by the end.
Right. And so yeah. When liberals engage, particularly liberals engage in that kind of like, well, you know, women actually got treated a lot worse after 79. It feels right. phony to me. It feels like because I mean. I'm sitting here as a guy that like doesn't engage in that, but right. at the same time, I didn't know what you just cited. You know what right. I mean? So I feel like the image often is one that is like speaking about women's rights in Iran without really even knowing what the situation is at all.
I mean, it's interesting you bring that
and
up.
And I'm not saying that to like be like, oh, yeah. women have it great in Iran or anything.
No,
I'm just,
of course.
But I feel like we have a stupid conversation about this often,
right?
You know,
and just to be clear, I'm pretty sure that currently women have it great nowhere,
mm-hmm.
and neither do men for the most part. It's kind of messed up all over the place.
I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, we have it a little more better.
I saw these girls going wild on a video once. They seemed like they were doing all right.
I don't even have television.
They seem really happy. I mean, it's just. But,
and I heard they made some money.
That's
but yeah, I mean, I wanted to interject the point you make. I mean, an example of this is. And again, this is something that I'll mention and I don't know about really, but I mean, there's this whole dynamic of sort of Western feminists, largely white American feminists, for example, interacting with like women or women's movement in the Middle East in this very, you know, kind of paternalistic, screwed up way.
Right.
It's like, we're going to, oh, so what do you guys need over here? We're going to, you know, that there's no like agency or mm-hmm. thought process about, you know, that these women in Iran aren't developing, haven't already read the same books that you have, or have read different books, or haven't read that book at all, but
right.
have developed their own, you know, and there's been, you know, a lot of discussion about those sort of issues among gender theorists and people who are concerned with that way beyond my knowledge. So I think that's one aspect you're getting about, is that it could be serving this imperial agenda,
right.
where Bush is going into Afghanistan for his imperial reasons, or an imperial agenda today vis-a-vis Iran
mm-hmm.
and the Obama administration, what it's doing there. But it can also be even serving this apparently soft, liberal, mm-hmm. you know, nice, we're just trying to be good feminists, you know, Saudi women are so this, Iranian women are so this. And not to say that there aren't tons of problems, but like, what is your, you know, what is your place? What is our place even
yeah.
as sort of left
right.
people in the U.S. that have concerns about these human rights issues? Like, you know, that's kind of when it becomes a more liberal kind of wishy-washy thing, that you see some of that in Argo and other films like that, that are not as on the face offensive orientalist stereotypes, although there is way more of that than people
say. Well,
said.
I mean, it's really complicated. And I think that's, yeah. I mean, maybe that's reflected in the conversation that we're having here, sitting talking about 1953 to 1979 in Iran,
right.
and we're reducing it to, well, how were the women treated?
Right.
And that's how we can judge the society. And certainly,
well, in fairness, that's just, you're the only one doing that here, because
right.
you're just clearly,
no, it's the only thing,
it's
the
a
only
problem
thing
you
I
have.
Know. Yeah.
yeah, it's all you know, and you just won't shut up.
I'm going to, no, but part of this podcast is watching me grow, you know, and
that's
and,
the part that I specifically said I did not
yeah,
want to be here for.
All right, well, we'll cut that
we'll
off.
Have to cut that
well,
out
yeah. Okay, we're back. All right. I want to pick up on the history again before we
yeah.
get back to Argo. So
yeah,
what
yeah.
What happens in 79? There, I mean, there's a revolution,
right?
And it's I teach this, and I teach it basically, you know, like from the Eric Foner book,
right.
which is that, I mean, he hits the
Eric Foner, for those out there, a prominent left U.S. historian who has a very serviceable textbook
called
of US
Give
history,
Me Liberty.
Called Give Me Liberty. But it's actually
that
good.
I've used many, many times.
It's good for a college level text.
Yeah,
I've used it too.
It's great. And I mean, his version of it is I mean, it's very upfront about the fact that this was the tone of it was specifically anti-American, because it was. And I don't employ that in a jingoistic fashion.
Right.
I just mean that that was the political goal, was to
right.
oust the influence of the United States from
right.
their country.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, was this an incredibly violent moment in Iran, this revolution?
I think it depends on how you define moment. There was a lot of a good amount of violence.
How bloody
up to
was
it.
This revolution, in other words?
It was relatively. I mean, there were a certain number of massacres, not in the like. Many thousands, in my understanding, in the hundreds. There were some significant ones that provoked further.
And the Shah flees.
And there's
where
this
does
interesting,
the Shah
there's
go?
A, it's interesting. There's interesting, like little detail about it that I do remember is this sort of, you know, Iran is a Shia Islamic country. There's a sort of cycle, and I'm not going to get the specifics of this right, of kind of mourning that's like a 60-day period. So you'd have these, you know, there'd be a kind of bloody incident. And then 60 days later, there'd be a event to mark that, and it would again be blood, and would sort of kick off this. So in a way, that the violence, the state repression the Shah was employing then, kind of, as is often the case, just exacerbated and accelerated the revolution itself, which really engrossed most levels of society. I mean, what's interesting about it is that the left had been decimated by the Shah to a degree. You know, leftists were down with the revolution, kicked the Shah out there. Some of them were kind of like, oh, this Khomeini guy, he's going to come in and whatever. You know, we'll kind of run him out of town. He's just this cleric dude,
right,
which was not what was going to happen. Then there were more religious people. I mean, you know, it was, I don't know what percentage of people in Iran were like, oh, we want to stick with the Shah, but it was, I think, vanishingly small. So it really was, it was a genuine revolution. I mean, that can't be understated, that like this was a societal.
And where did the Shah go? He wasn't killed.
No. I mean, I
know he ended up in New York City.
He ended
up
out
here. Hospital.
Yeah, I don't know if he went to, he might have gone to France. I don't know if he went to France. He left. He came to the U.S. He was treated for cancer. He died of cancer.
And it was an enormously controversial thing for him to come to the United States.
This is what gets us to the point and to this point in the history. And I mean, part of the issue with this, the history, and if I can just kind of go back to the art of him and link him together a little bit, but is that from the American perspective, you know, when you say Iran, one of the things you know is Iran hostage crisis.
Yeah.
That's it, right?
Right.
Well, this was a subcategory of a much larger world historical event that happened to affect a number of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Again, no fun for those folks, and not to say wonderful, you know, that was a huge important thing that you had to have this embassy take over and take these people hostage. I'm not in favor of taking people hostage in that context, but
I've always known you as someone that's something you've always had taken a hard line on. Is you're not in favor of taking people hostage.
You didn't know me in the 80s when I had some different viewpoints on podcasts and hostage taking.
It's a whole new you.
It is a whole, and that's the name of my podcast.
A whole new you.
Which no one will listen to.
Oh, that sounds
under
awesome.
Any circumstances. Oh, I don't even want to think about it anymore. But so you have this situation where, you know, the Iran hostage crisis is a thing. It's important. It's very important in U.S.-Iranian relations. But it's how Americans perceive Iran as this time where they took our guys.
Yes.
Okay,
and like a group of like crazy dudes.
And their group of crazy dudes in beards who are religious and they took our guys, right?
Yes.
And, well, why did they take our guys?
And take our guys, I mean, we're referring to, obviously, the Iranian hostage crisis, which is a moment where a group of student radicals take hostage some Americans that were at the diplomatic embassy.
Yeah, they're diplomatic folks.
They were like 66 of them, I think.
I forget the number.
Either way.
And my understanding of it from talking just kind of recently is I think that it really was sort of somewhat organic thing these young, you know, activists decided to do, and then sort of the government in power at the time just kind of had to roll with it because it was popular and made sense. But, well, why did they do this? They didn't do it because they were crazy or because they just wanted to, you know,
kill Americans.
Because none of them died at all.
Yeah.
None. You know, this is kind of forgotten.
I think that's something that
a lot of people don't know.
All of 66 of them were released.
My understanding, there definitely was mistreatment. There was, you know, torture to a degree, right? I mean, this is not acceptable. But the reason was the Shah, the guy, you know, imagine you just overthrew Saddam Hussein, right? Or maybe not someone at that level, but pretty bad. And the country that's propped him up for years is sheltering him and refusing to let him come back to the country to stand trial for crimes against humanity.
Right.
Basically. Or whatever they were going to, you know. This is what was going on, right? So there was a reason for this, and there's a historical reason for this, right? So when you get to Argo, which is a movie not just about a subset of world history, but a subset of the hostage crisis, because it's just about these six people that were in the Canadian ambassador's house. It's even more trivial than the overall hostage crisis, right?
It's a lens into the whole of Iranian history.
Yeah,
Jeff,
exactly.
Don't you understand that?
Exactly. Through the eyes of a Latino Ben Affleck, oddly enough.
Maybe that might be the best eyes to look at. Yeah.
Tony Mendez, I think that was the
CIA's Tony Mendez.
I have no idea what his background was actually, but it sounds a little bit Hispanic to be a bit racist, if I may.
Yeah, no, I like
that. Mendez sounds pretty.
That's a solid racist assumption.
Latino to me, but so you get the film. Then again, and this goes back to my point about the historical montage about the film that we kind of covered, right?
Right.
So it starts with this historical montage for a few minutes, and you're like, dope, 53, Mossadegh, CIA.
You said all that shit. Yeah.
You know, you got to start with that. Then it's like, that's over. Now, six people in the Canadian ambassador, CIA hero, swoop in, going to do this, right? And that's where everyone's head is. Meanwhile, how are Iranians being portrayed, right?
Yeah.
They're all crazy and angry. There's quite a bit of Farsi in the film, and I was watching it with one Farsi speaker and some other folks who weren't, so I was kind of getting that translated to me. Farsi is a language spoken in Iran primarily, obviously. And almost none of it translated. right? Mm. So when Iranians talk, it's like they're
gibberish.
They're literally talking gibberish, or they're mute. They have no.
What are their subtitles?
No subtitles. What that's what I'm saying. It's not translated.
See, this
it's
is
not translated.
This,
but then, wait, just one quick detail. Yeah. That's great. So towards the end, and we were commenting on this during the movie. It's like there's all this problems with the portrayals. There's inaccurate. It's made to look a little more crazy and violent than the revolution was. Not that there was a lot of violence eventually, but it was like a lot of it was perpetrated against like the left in Iran. I mean, mm-hmm. it was different ways than what you would think. It was certainly not Americans were being screwed over by this. But you get towards the end of the film where this film crew, you know, this fake film crew, as they do this fake movie or whatever. The whole reason it wins Best Picture is because it's Hollywood.
It's about Hollywood.
Hollywood jerking off to itself. And that's yeah. just like, you know, yeah. The Artist a couple years ago. Or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Like,
they love that kind of stuff.
They love that weird kind of like,
I don't know, benign self-reflexivity.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right.
That kind of salutes Hollywood yeah. in a kind of cutesy
like,
way.
Yeah, we're
kind of
great, but we're not really, whatever. So they get to the scene where they're making their grand getaway, which is totally fictionalized and was actually boring. But we've been commenting, they're never translating Farsi. And, you know, guys freaking out. Ron got the airport basically being like, who the hell are you? What are you doing? Where are your papers? And then the one American who knows a little bit of Farsi starts speaking. Then they start subtitling. Right, when he's showing them some Hollywood stuff.
Right.
And then they briefly subtitle the Iranian. But so you go through this entire film with no sense of the Iranian's perspective, right, at all. This is in the midst of their world historical revolutionary event.
Right.
You only care about this small subset of Americans. And it just it feeds into what's going on today with respect to Iran and the U.S., where it's like we're only concerned with whatever's happening in Iran and whatever the issue is how does it affect me? Not
right.
how
so,
does it affect
so
the Iranians?
So it sounds like your main beef, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but your main beef with Argo is not like specifically like, you know, this fact or that fact being twisted. It's more like a general kind of attitude, a general kind of like it's a problem of perspective. Like even when liberals talk about what the quote unquote problems in Iran, they're
right.
talking about them from a uniquely American perspective.
Right.
And I mean, you know, you might be thinking, well, how else are they supposed to think about it? They're
right.
Americans, but that's the problem. Like that's
right.
that set of eyes.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to like reveal how much of a 90s person I am, but there's that Rage Against the Machine song. That's like view the world through American eyes.
Right.
That kind of captures that. And that thing about Farsi, it reminds me of the movie Deer Hunter, which I've shown a few times in my Vietnam class. And
the torture scene, you mean, right?
Yeah, the torture scene. I mean, it's them playing the classic scene where they're playing Russian roulette.
Right.
And the Vietnamese are basically just like screaming at them the whole time
right.
in a kind of, there's no subtitles. It's just gibberish. And they sound like shrieking aliens. I mean, it's really,
right.
really grotesque. Like, I don't expect the portrayal of Iranians in Argo to be even that as bad. I can't even imagine it could be that bad. Because the Deer
right.
Hunter, I have so many Asian students in my classes at Baruch. I have, my classes are regularly, I would say, anywhere between 40 and 70% Asian,
right.
Asian kids. And they're just fascinated by this scene because they get a window into why this attitude is still so prevalent, this kind of this othering. I mean, it goes back to like this Saeed
yes.
thing, but it's like this kind of yes. idea of like these are others, these are aliens, these aren't humans, these are like
right.
whatever gibberish they're speaking doesn't even fucking matter.
It doesn't matter
because they could never say of anything of interest
right.
to me.
Because they're
and
just...
like I'll listen to them and I'll need the subtitles when they're talking to Ben Affleck.
Right.
But
right.
I don't need to.
Exactly.
But I don't need
exactly
to know. Like I need to know what that guy said to Ben Affleck.
Right.
But I don't need to know anything
yes.
else about
right.
like if he talks about his culture or
yeah.
anything, who cares?
It completely
and
strips,
that's a problem.
It completely strips any Iranian voice or any Iranian perspective out
right.
of this moment. People are like, well, look, the film is about these American guys. Okay, but why is the film about that and not about a broader thing? And why is that what the big Hollywood movie is? And why isn't, you know, not, I don't think it was some conspiracy. Michelle Obama reads that as
that
the,
was amazing
you know,
moment.
And it gets to these crazy moments.
Reads that with the CIA behind her. I mean,
yeah,
imagine
had Zero Dark 30 won. That would have been
right.
way more insane.
know,
you know, like, it would have just been. Like,
I've made that point a couple times about like the Michelle Obama CIA thing. I made the point that, you know, I'm not Alex Jones. I'm not looking for
no, I don't think
the Illuminati
conspiracy it,
but
all,
at the same
none.
Time, it's just like, wow, look at the CIA coming
That's
out.
That's a crazy moment where
yes.
you, I mean, I think there's nothing planned about that, but when she, you know, the wife of the President of the United States reads a film that ultimately, I mean, the CIA doesn't look completely amazing.
Can
but
I
like,
say
it's
she looked great, though.
Yeah, and I mean, was hoping we could get to this. Did you hear about...
I wanted to be balanced.
Apparently what... I think this happened. The Iranian government did this. They photoshopped sleeves into her dress.
Are you serious?
Yeah, isn't that awesome? Because we get to the other side of, you know... The Iranian government is also awful.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean,
right, and that's something that I want to get to because I know that's a big political point for you, how you don't fall into this trap. You know what I mean? Being against American involvement in Iran without being, you know, ultimately, you know, supportive of the Iranian government either. And that's, I think to me, that's obvious. That's an obviously easy thing to do because I usually don't like governments at all.
Right.
But at the same time, there is this narrative if you don't like the sanctions, then what, you're with the government?
Right.
So we'll get to that. I want to get to the current situation.
Right.
I mean, why don't we do that now? We've had the 79 revolution, and when the 79 revolution happens, you know, the Iranian hostage crisis is basically, like you said, how Americans perceive it.
Right.
Right. This is like Americans hear the story through.
It's the lens onto Iran.
Yeah. Right. You know, like I understand the Iranian revolution through what happened to 66 Americans.
Right. Exactly.
Like something that affected millions of people.
Right.
Is only understandable because, well, they fucked with 66 of our guys.
Right.
And so, okay, once that happens and Jimmy Carter bungles that whole thing, and there's a whole story behind that about Reagan that we won't necessarily get into. You can Google October Surprise Iranian Hostage Crisis and find out a little bit about that.
Or listen to my new podcast, October Surprise, airing Thursdays at no.
October Surprise. Yeah, it's only on in October. It's kind of bad marketing.
It's actually on in November. I totally fucked that up. That's the surprise.
Surprise, it's March. There's this revolution, and so what takes over, and what replaces the Shah?
So eventually you get, I mean...
We have this Ayatollah.
It's contested at first, and again, there's an assumption on my understanding, I'm not an expert in any sense in this, but
you're my expert now, Jeff.
But in an important way, I want to emphasize that because I'm not getting.
Yeah, no, I know. But you know more about it in this room than anybody. I mean, the cat knows a little.
Right.
But
yes, but is a sympathizer with the regime.
Yeah, I mean, the cat is ideologically biased.
Problematic, I think. But so, I mean, it's unclear exactly how it's going to shake out. Khomeini comes back from France. He's been in exile. He lands. It's a big deal. People are excited. But there's still a sense of like, okay, he's this doddering old mullah and whatever, you know, a lot of people like lefty and other type more organized folks, secular folks are like, well, we'll pay lip service to him and, you know, ultimately deal with him. But he maneuvers very well politically, has more support behind him and, you know, ascends to power, you know, the government goes through various changes and then he becomes the supreme leader. And he's in charge until he dies in 89, and they set up, you know, the Islamic Republic, which what Iran is called, the Islamic Republic of Iran, mm-hmm. You know, shorthanded IRA, and it becomes there were many Iranians who had in a sense, you can imagine it like you and I in the U.S., and sort of suddenly we reach a revolutionary moment, which we're nowhere near, right? Mm-hmm. And we're like, wow, this is amazing. And you are hopeful, or even maybe if you're naive, kind of assuming this is going to end up more in some better direction than where you were. And then like, you know, to be really crass about it, then like Rick Santorum takes over and you're like, what?
Yeah.
You know,
right,
I mean,
right,
and
right.
This is how some, and then suddenly you and I are being put in jail, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and this is sort of what happens there in the course of the 80s to a degree. And then Khomeini dies in 89. And Khamenei takes over. Just changed one vowel in our westernized version, who is still the supreme leader today. And you get this, you know, I mean, within that, there's different cycles. It's not, you know, it's like any country. Like, there's periods of reform when Mohammad Khatami was the president from, like, 97 to 2005, preceding Ahmadinejad, who we all know today. That was a period of relative reform. It was a bit of opening for a while. More newspapers being published. Student movement was important.
So you wouldn't even get the sense that there's been any fluctuation since 79 if
exactly.
you read the American press.
And which is ridiculous.
In 79, you know? Women were put in prison.
Right.
And that was
and
it.
And that was the end of it. They walk around in burqas or something, which is not even true, obviously. But
right.
Like, you know.
Right.
So that's, and then, you know, the basic power structure is there, but Iranian politics, which are incredibly, incredibly complicated, mm-hmm. you know, and... definitely since the Green movement in 2009, which was a very big deal, but not a revolution. The forces of reaction kind of clamped down and won that. And so this election that's going to be coming up, you know, there's not going to be anyone meaningful running in it who would go against the policies. Everyone who always runs for president has
and
to
so
be
approved. For those listening that know very little about this, the Ayatollah is still the leader of the country.
Right. Well, I mean, this...
He must be a very old person.
He's not that old. I mean, he's, I think, early 70s, if that. I mean, again, this is not the original Ayatollah. This is... Khomeini dies in 89. Khomeini takes over.
Okay, so he's replaced. So, How does
Ahmadinejad?
Yeah,
Ahmadinejad is the president. He's elected president.
As I understand it, he's not as powerful as the U.S. press portrays him as.
Not
like
at all.
People portray him as this like Hitler-like character, and they often like to cite that he once said that he'll wipe Israel off the map, and that's basically what. And I don't know if he even said that.
Not really.
Yeah,
there's a lot of like mistranslation.
Right, things, those are the two things that most Americans know about him, is that he's like some brutal guy that wants to kill the Jews.
Yeah.
And so, can you expand on that a little bit more about like what? I mean, the guy's a douchebag.
Yeah, he's the president. The president is elected every 4 years. Like here, they're limited to two terms.
He's a son of a bitch, but he's not our.
He's not our son of a bitch, and he's he does not control the nuclear arsenal. He had more political power a few years ago. Now he's on the way out. Even a couple years ago, you know, there was some sort of internal struggle between him and the supreme leader Khomeini, and that's the supreme leader totally won. And now someone else will be put in Ahmadinejad's place, and I don't know if Americans will just learn that name now, and that'll be the new evil guy, or if Khomeini will
become
the evil guy.
He'll have to say something about wiping Israel off the map.
Which, you know, it's not impossible, or they'll mistranslate it that way. But so, that position is not the most powerful position, and Ahmadinejad is viewed, I mean...
Is then the guy that makes that calls the shots on, like, foreign policy and things
absolutely,
like that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And whoever his, you know... people are.
Give me that pen. You're clicking the hell out of it.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right. I'll click it from now on.
Great. I wasn't really that was
you were
my
totally
security
unaware
blanket.
Of it, right?
That was I was.
I'll click it for you. There's the final click.
Didn't that make a sort of an interesting background noise?
It was like kind of almost like a beat to what you were saying, but a really like experimental type beat, like totally, you know, like time shifting and stuff like that. But we'll talk about music another time.
I'd like to cut to that now.
All right, we'll cut to that. So where were we? We're talking about you were talking about Ahmadinejad.
That takes us up to the present, is what you wanted
okay,
to do.
Okay, so
right?
we're at the present, and how has, because during the Bush years, I just felt like I remember, you know, and listeners of this show know that I'm not necessarily proud of this, but I'm prone to a kind of apocalyptic hysteria about things, and certainly that was fueled by becoming politically aware during the Bush years, when there was a certain kind of hysterical tone to the left and the right, I would say, actually.
Right.
Things were amped up during those years,
and
my own kind of formulation during this era of, like, I was trying to glean what are the motivations of the Bush administration, what do they really want, and I felt like Iraq was just Iraq was a step towards war with Iran,
right?
And that's how I perceived it, and I thought, oh, they're going to go to war with Iran, and that's what all this propaganda about Ahmadinejad hating the Jews is about, and that's why, you know, they're laying the groundwork for that. But then that didn't happen, and I thought, okay, Obama will step in and he'll have a much more kind of conciliatory tone towards them. But what is the tone that Obama has struck? And like, can you update us a little bit on like what is going on?
Well, that's what I think is sort of interesting, is that, you know, there was a hope that, you know, Obama's administration would take a like more conciliatory, more diplomatic. And I think initially there was the guise of that, at least. And I certainly think there's less threat of war instigated by the U.S. under an Obama administration than there was under, you know, a Dick Cheney administration.
Right.
Although ultimately Cheney would have gone to war, but he didn't pull it off, from my understanding. But that's not for any particular moral concern. It's because it's perceived as like bombing, and by war in this initial stage, we would mean like bombing Iranian nuclear facilities, which may or may not be related to manufacturing a nuclear weapon. No one really knows on that. It's generally unknown by anyone.
Yeah.
But the reason the Obama administration wouldn't go to war is because they think it's strategically stupid, which is correct, I think. It's just like what follows after that you don't know, and it has potentially dire consequences. But what they have done, and this again kind of relates to how Americans or a lot of people in the West perceive Iran or don't see what's happening, is the Obama administration has, you know, as a lot of people know, radically tightened the sanctions regime that in various manifestations and has been present in Iran going back to the 80s.
Those sanctions go through the UN, is that right?
They go through
UN sanctions, but the US is kind of
They go through a variety of, there's UN, there's EU, there's US law, there's a number of, I've read a lot about this, I can't begin to unpack it all.
And all of these sanctions.
The Obama administration for the last few years is the driving force
behind
the sanctions.
Okay, and the sanctions are ostensibly because Iran is attempting to build a nuclear weapon.
That's right, and it's ostensibly targeted at the government. Think groups like the Revolutionary Guard, you
which
know,
in
who
itself
are shitty,
is insane.
But,
I mean, I'm not a diplomatic expert at all.
Right.
I understand that this is a simplistic view of nuclear diplomacy.
Right.
But it's kind of, I mean, it's just insane to think like you can't have what we have thousands of.
Well,
you know, like
or what Israel has hundreds of, or
like,
however many they have, which is your neighbor.
By
you're surrounded by it.
And not only that, your neighbor is antagonistic towards you.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit, about like Iran and Israel relations? I mean, I know that's a huge topic, but
well,
like,
I mean,
just in a general way, that I mean, this tension is.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, they're fighting. You know, they're
why is Israel? What is Israel's beef with Iran?
Well, I don't. I mean, it's on multiple levels. It gets to the point where there's a number of people in Israeli politics who I'm sure are generally concerned. They really believe Iran's going to, you know,
they're
blow
a threat.
Them off
the
map.
That's
a genuine political current in Israel. I think that's ludicrous because the Iranian Republic, although it's a horrendous regime and they do terrible things, they're not irrational actors. If they blow up Tel Aviv, the country's done. You know, that's the end of Iran. So that's
the Israeli government
issue.
Is also an irrational, insane regime, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you and I are working on that assumption.
Not.
Like neither of them are irrational and insane. They're actors. They're actors in the region who are terrible actors, who are doing terrible things.
Right.
But they're, I mean, you know, Netanyahu's government's a little more whacked out than some have been, definitely. Mm-hmm. But like, I mean, so there's that political fear. But I mean, it's an issue of regional dominance and power. I mean, it's like anything in geopolitics, right? Like Iran is a big, rich, powerful, well-educated country that it does not play ball, and it's a counterpose to, and it would be a counterpose to the U.S. and Israel, even under a more like secular-friendly regime to a significant degree, which there's a naivete behind that. But like, that's not good, right? Like the Saudis play ball.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have a problem with it. The Egyptians, you know, who knows, that's changing.
Also, are
also play ball.
Extremely wealthy there.
Yeah. Well, in Iran, I mean, Iran is, you know, and it's also Iran. You know, Iran is Shia. So this other, you know, within the Muslim context, there, you know, the Saudis have a problem with it because they're a Sunni country. So there's that rivalry. So there's all these factors going on. I mean, it's basic geopolitics, and what you're getting under the Obama administration is the sanctions policy that's ostensibly targeted at the government, ostensibly targeted at the, you know, elite forces in the Revolutionary Guard, which are a repressive, bad group, and, you know, are not something that in many means I would support, but really have been generalized to the entire citizenry of Iran and people even outside of Iran. This is how and what's so fascinating.
So I just want to underline that point is that the sanctions that are aimed at hurting the government of Iran and preventing them from creating a nuclear weapon are actually taking a devastating toll on the people of Iran who don't have anything to do with that.
Right. And a huge percentage of human, you know,
what's happening to people in Iran right now is not fair. And
right.
And the sanctions that the United States is imposing upon them are destructive to Iranian society in like a really basic way. Like we're talking about food and medicine.
Right. And I mean, especially with medicine, but I mean, and then again, these are people who a large percentage of whom are actively opposed to the regime, who were in the streets a few years ago, opposed to the regime, who a lot of Americans identified with and said, wow, that's so cool what those guys are doing against the mullahs.
And that's not inadvertent. It's not like Obama is saying, oops, you know, I didn't mean for the sanctions to hurt the people. I'm really just trying to fuck with the government.
Right.
Obama's policy, in a real way, is a very close or heading towards like a starvation policy of like starve these people out.
Well, and
I mean, it really is. Marilyn Young in her book about Vietnam describes U.S. policy as the quote unquote logic of the rack,
right,
which is that like just hurt these people
until they
give up.
Right.
And that's, I just want people to understand that that's the U.S. policy towards Iran right now.
It is. I mean, this is what, you know, I say, and people who are involved with activism say, is sanctions are a form of warfare.
Oh,
lots
yeah.
of people
oh,
who,
yeah.
lots of people
Absolutely.
Who are I mean, lots of liberal total anti-war people.
You can do give genocide the argument with sanctions.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we did in, yes, did in Iraq.
Many
like
times.
Lots of people who are liberal anti-war will be like, well, what else are we going to do? This is better than doing war. Well, it's okay. Is it better than a mass bombing campaign that kills 300,000 people? Well, sure. But it's a form of warfare, and don't mistake it for being something else. And what I think is very two-faced about it is you get one side of the rhetoric from the administration is very much like, you know, this is targeted at the government. Mm. The other side of the rhetoric, you know, Biden has said this repeatedly, lots of people, is that was in the presidential debates and vice presidential debates, for God's sake.
Right.
This is the strictest sanctions regime we have ever seen. It is
bragging
all
about
levels,
it.
Bragging
yeah.
about how horrendous it is, right? So one thing that is particularly affected
it's
is
like
with,
we starve the shit out of those kids.
Yeah, and that what the theory, and then the, if you push them to the end of that theory, it's like, well, if we make people mad enough, they'll overthrow the government and that'll be good. Now, forget the fact that most people, I mean, there's split, you know, you don't want to.
Is that really what the U.S. wants? Some sort of like organic revolution again?
Oh, no, not an organic. Trying, no, I mean, what
are we trying to foment?
There'd
some
be
sort
love.
Of,
I mean, the U.S. government, like anywhere like this, would love mean? Would love for the government that's opposed to them to be toppled, and that they could, as they've tried to do with Egypt and other places, you know, not necessarily very often successfully, but sometimes successfully, whatever comes next is more amenable to them. They'll get behind popular forces that do that as
right,
long as it can
right.
be in check enough.
Right. So, you know? I mean, what's the long-term plan as you see it?
I don't, I mean, I think the, I think, I don't, first of all, I
we're
don't,
not, we're
I,
not
I genuinely,
wizards that
I genuinely,
can tell the future,
I genuinely don't know that, you know, folks in the U.S. administration know what their long-term plan
yeah,
is exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's a mix of cause a lot of pain in, I mean, part of it is just weaken Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It's strong, make it weaker, and we can weaken through this way. And then, yeah, I'm sure there's people in the State Department and elsewhere who think that this is, despite historical evidence to the contrary, this kind of imposed sanctions regime, last example, look at Iraq, does not lead to people over toppling them. And,
right.
and again, what I was going to say is a lot
but
of people.
But what about all those Iraqis that pulled the Saddam Hussein statue?
Yeah, exactly. That was a wonderful photo op. But right. like a lot of people in Iran. A significant percentage of people involved in the political protests are like, we do, you know, don't do this. We don't want this.
Right.
We don't want sanctions. We don't want use intervention. We don't want your help. It doesn't help us. It makes it harder to do what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
We wanted, you know, like anyone, like if we were in this country, we'd be like, hey, Russia, do you want, you know, do you want some help? Like, no. This is, you know, the politics of our country are the politics of our country. So there's, it's ridiculous to think that this will lead to this, but the result of it is, yeah, genuine, real suffering, and it's, you know. It's more reported in the media, but it's, you know, food isn't so much per se. Like, it's not the way people are starting to say.
Did Argo indicate anything, like, try to locate anything in the present?
Nothing whatsoever.
About, like, oh, this is what Iran is like today.
And
it was literally about these guys that made this movie once.
It was just about that. And that, but what I found relevant to the present was in terms of just shifting the American part. And so it drove me crazy a couple days later after the Oscars, you know, the big story about Iran on CNN.com, you know, I just check that periodically to see what the corporate media says, like,
right.
was like, do the hostages from that crisis, do they deserve reparations? Let's spend a lot of time on this.
Holy
and I'm like,
hell.
you know what,
are
to
you
me, it's
kidding
like,
me? They really ran that?
They wrote a whole thing about it. You know, they're asking for, and you know what? I don't know. Maybe, yeah, give those guys $1 million.
Sure.
I don't care.
Yeah.
That's fine. I get it. That
right.
was a terrible thing to go through.
Right.
But that's not, right now, there's a bunch of Iranians with, like, MS, cancer, other diseases that can't, because of U.S. sanctions, because of all these complicated ways it plays out, they can't get drugs
right.
that treat them in hospitals
right.
that are being turned away. You know, this is a thing that's happening. It's getting more media coverage, right? But people are, we don't know to what degree people are dying from this. And it's because of something the Obama administration is doing, ostensibly because they're mad at the government, that a lot of these same people who can't get the drugs are also mad at.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an insanity to this.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is just, I think that actually, I genuinely think with this foreign policy issue, there's some things where I think Americans are more reactionary as a public or on the wrong, from my perspective, wrong side. I think if more people knew about this, they'd be a little appalled.
Yes,
like,
yes.
you know, the Green
the
Green Movement folks, remember those folks from
a few
years ago?
I think it's wrong
to
think that Americans will all sign off on this shit.
Yeah,
they don't
know
about it.
They don't know about it.
And if they did, they wouldn't. I don't mean to say that if people knew the truth they would revolt.
Right.
I don't mean that.
No,
I
not
just
that
mean,
at all.
I just mean that in a general way, they wouldn't, like, if you explain this to your mom. Well, I don't know about our moms, but
not
my
mom,
right? But if you explain this to a mom that doesn't know about this,
a generalized mom,
right?
A composite mom,
yeah, like kind of the universal mom. If you explain this to an American mom or American dad, you know, they might be. I think they would be sympathetic, and they would be, if not outraged, they would certainly be have their mind changed a little bit about what's happening over there. And so, you are involved in this, and by involved I mean you're an activist. You're someone who has kind of started participating with a specific group. Is that called Havar?
Havar,
is that
right?
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah.
And explain, you know, what I want to know is, because I've known you for a long time, and we've both been kind of, you know, generally lefty type people that are show up for this or that event. You've definitely been more of on the activist end than I have, but I've certainly saw you at Occupy a couple times.
Right.
But either way, so for a person like you that's been involved in a number of causes over the years, specifically a lot of foreign policy stuff, it seems like that's your main concern.
Right.
Why is it that Iran is the most urgent issue for you to get involved with right now? Like, why did you get involved with it, and what's been your experience?
Yeah, well, and there's a couple of reasons. One, just a personal one, for I've had Iranian friends for a number of years and have come to make a lot more in the last year or so.
Iranian-American friends?
Iranian-American friends, okay. Yeah. Sorry. Going back to college. So there's that aspect to it. But even beyond that, it's just, you know, roughly a little over a year ago, I mean, there was really the steady drum of war beating vis-a-vis Iran. It got really intense. And I was like, I haven't, you know, I've been involved.
McCain in 2008 was a bomb with that awful
but
joke.
But this was, I mean, particularly a year ago, there was this sort of a lot of it was from Israel. Like, Israel is more the military threat, right? And it was looking bad. And I felt that I'd kind of, you know, I've done anti-war stuff going back a long time, but just kind of on and off and sometimes very intensely, but that I needed to get involved with this. So I started, you know, went to this kind of Occupy anti-war group, and that was kind of fizzled and wasn't much of anything. But then I eventually got connected and got to know, and then later over last summer got involved with this group, Havar, which is largely Iranians and Iranian Americans, and then there's a few people like me, kind of like ally members that are not Iranian but help and, you know, do what we can to do stuff. So Havar is created like a year ago, and it, you know, takes us, what you mentioned earlier, more kind of complicated position, which is to be very opposed to the war, any prospect of war with Iran, very opposed to any sanctions with Iran, but also opposed to the state repression and other policies of the Iranian government. And I think this is part of why I got excited about this, and it's part of what's important.
So it's a group that's basically recognizing that the Iranian people are being mistreated by both sides of their institutional authority, that being in the guise of American and, you know, I guess the UN, but I really think of that as American still. Americans threatening Iran, Israel threatening Iran,
right.
and then their own government being shitty to them too.
Right.
If anyone deserves our sympathy, really, it's the Iranian people.
Right.
I think it's important
for this, but I also think there's a couple things about it. On the one hand, for a lot of Iranians, they will actually, not wrongly at all.
Can I just correct that and say empathy instead of sympathy?
Thank you.
I hate that kind of like paternalistic, like pity shit.
Thank you. I was going to call you on that, but this is your podcast. And
you can do it on your podcast.
Yeah. And that'll be airing again in late April. November surprise. but on the one hand, like, it's what I've learned from this, and part of it's interesting, is a lot of Iranians, like, their thing is they'll be like, yeah, American imperialism, whatever. My day-to-day is my government screwing me, right?
Yes, yes.
Who are you to tell me that it's more this, right? So there's this problem on the American left and the anti-war movement of, like, this position that's advocated, that we just said, that you say, it's very common sense. Of course, these are all horrible actors. All these governments are just awful.
Right.
And our sympathies with these people is oddly controversial on the traditional anti-war, anti-imperialist left. Some people, because there's the one crazy extreme of people who are like, Ahmadinejad is anti-imperialist, he's not so bad, which is bonkers town, right?
Yes.
But then other people who are like, this is kind of controversial, we shouldn't take a position on, and it's not taking a position like, I want to vote in Iranian politics, I don't. But what to me should be obvious, and it goes with the spirit of Occupy, very much so, and transnational solidarity in general, is just like, look, wherever, you know, there are folks who are getting it from the government, from the business, whatever, some level of oppression, economic, police state, whatever, I'm in sympathy with those folks. Mm-hmm. Like, in their society, I'm not going to go over there and tell them what to do with that society, right?
Right.
But Iranians are getting it from a lot of different places. But I think the reality is this in our modern, you know, well, it's always been true, but in this era, this is kind of how we have to approach all these international questions, I think, to some degree, right? It's not just enough to be like, I'm opposed to U.S. imperialism. That's for me or you. That's a given. Of course you're that, and harshly so, and as we're Americans, we work against that, and we do try to maybe more strongly influence our own government, right?
Right.
But I want to have solidarity with people from all over the place, right? So if I have people in Iran who are like, you know, our government is the biggest problem right now, so when you go and do your peace rally, say something like that. And to give us a concrete example, the reason Havar was formed, this is before I was involved with them, they went to, you know, kind of a left anti-war rally. And because this had happened previously, this is a real thing that happened. Iranian state TV, this is hardly surprising, will go, and they have camera people here, you know, press TV.
Right.
They will go to anti-war rallies opposing war with Iran, film them, and be like, look at these Americans supporting the Ahmadinejad regime, right? So you had Iranians in this group of ours that, you know, this
How complicated that is.
Exactly. Yeah. Some of whom, you know, in Iran faced political repression, literally, right? So they go to, they intentionally go to this rally with signs that are more complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no to war, no to U.S. imperialism, no to sanctions, no to state repression in Iran.
Right.
And get flack from this anti-war movement, like, don't put that no state repression thing in there. That's kind of, but they're doing it. So in the country that some of these, you know, some of my Iranian friends, as opposed to Iranian American friends, live in and want to go back to, or maybe can't, it's like where their political soul is, you know,
it's being
co-opted by the reactionary forces when they come here, you know. So, and I think we have to think not just about Iran. Iran is just the thing right now because it's the main target of U.S. warmongering and that thing, and this warful sanction policies. We have to think about that for, in general, right? How do we, as people who want to have solidarity with people all over the world, you know, not just like, well, Iranians told me to do this, so this is what I do. I'm not saying, like, you know, willfully following whatever someone in other country says, but being very aware of the political situation in other countries and what people face. And I think that's part of why I was drawn to this very complex. I mean, it's a position
how does Havar get through this tangled web of you know, between state repression and American sanctions?
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's still something that's being pieced through, and I mean, it's like a year old, but
actions.
There's been a few things that we've done so far, and again, I was an outsider for a decent chunk of this, but you know, when a new sanctions regime went in, there was protests at the various UN missions of European countries last summer. When Ahmadinejad was in charge in town for the General Assembly in September, we protested him. But also, so one thing was, we had a huge banner that was like, you know, we were calling it the three idiots. It was Obama, Ahmadinejad, and Netanyahu from Israel, and making the point for, you know, in their different ways, they're all doing horribly destructive things, and they don't care about the Iranian people. That's a, like, shockingly complex message to take those three people and say
I mean,
right?
It's really appealing to me, because it's like, it reminds me of, like, I turned off Bob Dylan before you got here, and he said, you know, don't follow leaders and watch the parking meters. And it's like this kind of, like, vague anarchism to the Havar organization in a sense, because they're saying, like, every form of institutional leadership is corrupt, and it's the people themselves that are the target of all these policies,
right.
and that's where our work needs to be, is like with the people
and
themselves.
That's where our strength was, right? There's no way to like really oppose these things well,
right,
without like solidarity across borders among people.
Yeah,
like, you're not gonna do it through a government, you know, you're just not, and that's incredibly hard and complicated, and God knows it's not like any of us know exactly how to do it,
but yet it's intuitive.
It's intuitive,
we saw it with the Occupy Sandy thing we're seeing here, where it's just like, and I've mentioned the Occupy Sandy thing before, and we'll hopefully talk about more about what we witnessed and what we've kind of experienced here about that, the Occupy relief effort for the Sandy hurricane here in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, in which we kind of witnessed, like, people just kind of doing shit themselves without any institutional authority telling them what to do. And in fact, the National Guard showing up and asking Occupy leaders,
like,
where should we go? Where should we go? What should we do?
Here's some stuff. Can you distribute it?
Right. Like, which is amazing. And you kind of like watch this like organic revolution take place right in front of you. It's just people. And it's nothing. There's nothing revolutionary about it beyond people just saying, hey, we need water. Let's go. Get some water.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, that's what's beautiful about it. But does the Havar organization, like, do they get stuff into Iran? Like, do they get medicine to people that need it? How do they?
The current thing.
Are they more an activist organization that's trying to call attention to the problem?
Yeah, it's a bit more at that level. And it's very, I mean, it doesn't have any money. It's just a bunch of people who, you know, kind of know each other. And
is it
it's
primarily in New York City?
It's in New York City. It's based here. I mean, there's, you know,
there's a large Iranian population.
There's a huge Iranian diaspora across the world. So there's connections in other places and things we want to work more on.
When people flee Iran now, they're fleeing, they could be fleeing a whole host of things. They could be fleeing state repression. They could be fleeing the sanctions.
They could be studying abroad.
Yeah.
And this, you know, and this is one of the things we talk about too, is, I mean, these sanctions are so intense that they affect Iranian students here. Iranian, I mean, I don't know how much you ever know about this, David, but it's interesting. Like in Minneapolis, where I'm from, Iranian students at the University of Minnesota, one particular bank, the first bank account I ever had as a kid, closed their accounts basically because you're Iranian.
Yeah.
I mean, straight up. So things like that are happening. That's what the sanctions are so intense. They've gone beyond, you know, the confines of the state of Iran to, like, they follow you around if you're Iranian, like when you go out into the world, you have a problem with it, right?
And I, so this I can, is I just some... hear a lot of skeptical people being like, that doesn't happen. You only get followed around in your bank clothes if you did like some crime or something.
Right, but I mean, it's just, it's not true. There's bigger in the so media. There was an Apple store in Atlanta that refused to sell to an Iranian American, someone who's a citizen here, because they're like, well, you have an Iranian name, we have bad relations. I mean, and this is part of what's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine, Ruzbe, is going to be publishing an article that's probably going to deal with this, so I'll credit him with this idea. But this is part of what's messed up about this big new sanctions regime. It's almost sort of this sort of, I don't know if you want to call it outsourcing or something of like U.S. foreign policy to these companies that don't have a way to do this, right? So you make this super strict sanctions rule, right? Mm. And if you're a bank and you break it, you can get fined millions and millions of dollars by the U.S. Treasury Department, and it's happened already.
So
right?
the order is from the U.S. government involved in the sanctions and aiming at Iranians in America.
Right. It took me a while to
kind of understand exactly the chain of how that happened.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily that it's aimed. It's more that the sanctions are just made super strict, and the way it works is the U.S. government, if you go to them, they'll say, well, there's an exemption for medicine. Of course you can send medicine.
Right.
Well, you can't, because the way that the transaction is supposed to happen through banks, which is the only way to buy anything, obviously,
yes,
is so limited that most banks won't do it. And then so the U.S. government just says, what's the bank's fault? And the banks are like, we're scared shitless. We don't know how to do this, right? Mm. So it's sort of like outsources the, you know, the oppression or the discrimination or whatever to TCF Bank in Minnesota or Apple in Georgia or TD Bank in Canada, right? And these are not institutions that are capable of like crafting a form. And I don't even know what that means, but that's the thing that's going on. So in Hvar, what we're starting is this anti-sanctions campaign that we've started. And we're starting with a petition, and it's going to go beyond that, particularly targeted at the medicine issue, because ostensibly you are supposed to be able to buy medicine if you're an Iranian pharmaceutical company and you want to buy cancer drugs to sell to a hospital. But you kind of have to do all these roundabout ways, or you can't. Inflation and other things have made the price go up. Mm-hmm. So we're working on pressuring banks, for starters, ultimately, you know, the government ultimately, and drawing attention to these issues.
Yeah.
And you know, we're looking and we'll have, I think, some sort of allies internationally to do that as well. And it's just one, you know, trying to keep in mind the whole time, the sanctions are one part of this picture, because
who knows, you got the
war threat overhanging it, right? And you also don't want to pretend, you know, the Iranian government's part of the sanctions problem.
Right.
It starts with the U.S. government. The Iranian government's corrupt and does all these bad. So I'm very challenged by it. And I mean, I think it's important work to do, but it's sort of intellectually and a sort of, you know, very, ooh, I'm just a stepped back white dude who doesn't have a stake in it way. Challenging and I think important to try to think through these problems, because they are so, you know, in order to have a meaningful anti-war, anti-imperialist, left solidarity movement, you know, we got to figure this shit out. I don't know how to do it. I mean, it's the same way. It's just like automatically you got to have solidarity with Palestinians, right? Automatically, even, and we'll do
shows about all these.
Yeah,
I would like to do a show about as much geopolitical stuff as we can, because it's stuff that, like, I don't feel like I know a lot about, yet at the same time, it's been stuff that's been kind of my entry into understanding a whole host of stuff about American history and the place of the United States within the landscape of the rest of the world. I'll put this up on the Topical Fever website. But the website for Hvar is hvar.org, which is HAVAAR.org. So check that out if you're interested in what.
And if you want to sign the petition that we're asking people to sign, if you just go to hvar.org/medicine, you also see it on the main page. You can stick your name there, and then we're going to be gathering a bit more of that, and then
I'll spread some of this stuff around as much as I can, because I think it's important too. And I just wanted to thank you for coming in, Jeff.
You've made me a convert to podcasts.
All right. So
I'm sorry about the poopy smell.
It's all right. We're gonna clean that up and talk to Jeff again very soon. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, David.